Hello?
To collect call from
Life of a Lifer.
To accept this call, press 5 now.
Hello and welcome, friends and family. Today we have a special program for you. We got a man who was actually serving time behind walls, but not just serving time. This man had a life sentence, and he was able to, through working his master plan, make his way out. I've spoke about it before. I spoke a little bit about the book when I read it not too long ago. But today, we got the man with us. Takes us all the way out to Baltimore, and I would like to introduce you to Mr. Chris Wilson. You there, Chris?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for the warm introduction, and I'm happy to join you today.
Yeah, man, it's great to have you. You know, I envision what you've done, and I see this master plan that you've created and developed. You know, you had the vision from basically the time, a little bit after you entered into the system, you developed this, and you realized that you wanted to do something more with your life than just, you know, that prison wasn't the end of it for you. You want to tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, it was one of those situations where I went to prison at a young age. I was 17 when I caught my charge. By the time I was sentenced, I had just turned 18, and I fell into a deep depression, and I just felt like I wasted my life. And I knew in my heart I was a good person. I knew that I always wanted to contribute to my community. I knew that I was always an entrepreneur. And so I was angry at myself. And so around this time, I decided to come up with what I call my master plan, which was essentially a bucket list of things that I wanted to accomplish. I wanted to graduate college, and I wanted to, you know, learn foreign languages. I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to, you know, build businesses, things that I used to dream of. And so I decided to write things up and prove to myself and prove to the world that my life was redeemable. And so that was like the genesis of the master plan. That's how it started.
Yeah, man, that's very well put, because a man without a plan doesn't have direction. And so I think that it's important to, you know, not just make a plan, but to write it down. And you took those steps, and it shows in your book, like the very first master plan that you made and what you had on it. And then as it progresses, it kind of like gets more in depth, a little bit more detailed each time that you show it, you know, and you add some things on there and break it down more and, you know, set these goals for yourself, and then you work along the way to achieve them. I really think that, you know, one of the points that you press all the way through it is what's your end game. So I'd like to hear more about what the end game is all about.
Absolutely. You know, you make a good point about writing stuff down, and it was something, I guess, inside of me that when I'm writing something down on paper, that it's law. It's, you know, I'm a man of my word, so I have to do it. And what I also did was I shared that list with my judge. I shared it with my grandmother. I mean, everyone listens to their grandmother. So it's important to share your list, your master plan with someone and give them the power to hold you accountable. And so that's what I started out by doing that. And then I just started working the plan. But what I had to think about before I executed the plan was, where's the finish line? What's the end game? And so I was 19, but I thought about, like, who would I be at the age of 40? You know, I didn't know the term social entrepreneur at the time, but I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur that helped my community, that improved the environment. And I knew I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to buy my dream car. I'm really into cars. And I just wanted to be a good person. And so once I envisioned what that end game was, then I had to plan backwards and think about what are all the things that I need to learn and do in order to make this come true. And so education, I needed to embrace therapy to figure out what led me to prison. What are some things that I could equip myself with so that I can be more successful once I was released? And then finally, the end game, I had a life sentence. So and finally, I had to really believe that I could pull it off. And so I call it a positive illusion in the book. And I just had to believe that I would be free one day and that it would happen. And that gave me the strength the energy to get up every morning in prison, despite the lockdowns and, you know, power going out and all of that stuff. It gave me the energy to push forward and work.
Yeah, man, that's some very motivational and inspirational stuff right there, because the power of believing in something, especially oneself, is definitely what it takes to compel you to move forward and take action on those goals, regardless of whether you write them down or whoever you tell, because those things are definitely very important. But you have to also believe in yourself so
right.
you were able to do that and pull it off. And that's amazing. You know,
thank
and
you. Yeah.
You mentioned something there that, you know, rings true to me. Like, I was taking this class and it was called, it was like a program. It was called Roots of Success. And, Van Jones is actually like on the board of directors of this program. It's through,
oh, nice.
Like, it's through a, college in San Francisco. And basically one of the it's about sustainability. It's about, you know, learning, you know, things with the environment. And also one of the big modules that was in there was social entrepreneurship, right? And this was a few years ago that I learned about this concept of social entrepreneurship, because like you, I'm really infatuated with business. You know, I used to use it for illicit endeavors, like, you know, I used to sell drugs, I used to hustle, I used to do all that stuff from a really early age, from like the age of 11, 12 years old, I got into doing that. And so when I began to grow up and turn my life into something positive, it took me like five or six years after being down to really turn things around. But once I started to do that, and then I learned about this concept of the social entrepreneurship, it really, like, it got me going, man. I really thought, I was like, man, this is the solution right here to
absolutely
a lot of the problems.
Absolutely.
Like,
it's the same thing that happened to me.
This concept is amazing. Yeah.
That's awesome. And it's like, you can make money and still do good in the world. And that's the thing that people think, like, yeah, you make a lot of money and you become some evil person, but you can do that and pay it forward and help people and lift people alongside of you. Like, that's in my philosophy. Like, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I watch Shark Tank a lot, right? That's like my favorite show. And so I even seen Mark Cuban on there. He was like, this is the future right here. Social entrepreneurship is the future. That's the way of the future. And then, you know, I read in Entrepreneur Magazine about, you know, at this big company called SAP, and they really believe in social entrepreneurship so much that they'll even give their employees like grants and money and back them up with a network to be able to start social entrepreneurship. It's basically like the concept of giving, you know, towards a good cause, plus giving like 50% of the profits go back into the cause. You know what I mean? And that's kind of,
yeah, I love it.
Like, my social enterprise is, that's the concept of my social enterprise, to help people that's in prison while they're still in prison, and then bridging the gap between incarceration and society. So
right.
I just think that what you're doing is really amazing, as far as the fact that you've been able to conceptualize all this stuff and then seeing it come to life. You know, I've heard a lot about the things that you got going on, and I understand that you're quite an artist, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a big passion of yours. And, I'd like to hear more about that.
I started painting about 4 or 5 years ago. And one of my artist friends his name is Jeffrey Kent. I was working with him as a contractor, just moving paint in to move in studios back and forth. But we became friends, and I would spend time with him while he would paint and make art. And he would paint about social justice issues, race relations, like deep stuff. And for my birthday a few years ago, he gave me a few art lessons for free. And I didn't want it to at first. I was like, give me some money for my birthday. Like, I'm not interested in art, but I took about 2 classes. And I fell in love with art. It just became so powerful. It was like Neo in the Matrix when he started to see the binary code. I just started to see the world differently. and it just took off. And so that was about 4 or 5 years ago. And I've traveled the world. I worked and sold paintings in France and Italy and South America and just traveled around. It just allowed me to help so many people. And now I'm addicted. Now I'll never stop.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. And I understand, too, that you were, I mean, in reading your book, you did some actual, like, mural painting inside a prison. So you already had a little bit of art.
So Stephen was the artist, and I would mix the paint and clean up the brushes after the work. And so now the roles have reversed. Like, so now he has a software company. He's doing well. And when I'm selling paintings all around the world, he says, you know, you were inspired by me, so I should be getting 10% of all your art sales. That's what I laugh about.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Yeah. No, that's great.
I have a question for you, if you don't mind me asking. So
yeah, man.
I'm really big. So just some additional stuff about me. I work with an ed tech company that provides tablets for folks incarcerated at no charge, right? So there are some companies that provide tablets and they charge you for transactions to talk to your family. So the company that I do some work for and that I'm invested in is APDS. And I just created a masterclass that will accompany the book that will help people come up with their own master plan. So it's a couple of videos and some quizzes, and it's really interesting. All my art's on there too. And I'm a big believer that a lot of people in prison don't belong there. I think people in the communities have been shortchanged on education and made decisions that allow them to end up in prison. And so one of the things that has kept me home once I made it out was the education that I embraced when I was in prison, getting my college degree, mentoring, reading books. And so I've been championing that cause all around the country to help people embrace education so that when they get home, they can get a job, they can start their own business if they want, and they stay home and they don't go back to prison. But I'm interested in your perspective.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Real briefly, what do you see that can be, how do you feel education could play a role in the prison that you're in right now?
I think that education is one of the most crucial and critical aspects to keep people from coming back to prison. Because without any type of education or knowledge, aside from the street knowledge and, you know,
you have 30 seconds remaining.
The same type of activities, there's not going to be a break in that cycle unless, you know, right, something extraordinary happens. But the more, and I found this from personal experience, the more that I've been able to get education into my life, the more it makes me want to do things in a positive direction. Like, because you understand things on a fundamental level.
So, one of the reasons why I felt like it was important to tell my story by writing the master plan is because I always knew I was a good person. I wasn't violent. I wasn't really interested in selling drugs. I just wanted to live a regular life. But there were so many conditions in my community that made it so difficult for me to make that happen. So I went to a bad school. There was a lot of gun violence. My neighborhood was flooded with crack cocaine in late 80s, early 90s. The police policed differently in my community. You know, my mom was a single parent. There was just so many things that led me to go to prison. And this happens, as you know, all around the country. So I'm interested in your case, or people that you know, what are your thoughts on the community environment, our schools, especially for young people? Do you have any opinions on how things could be better, or what do you think about it?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that, because, you know, I realized, you know, a while ago, years ago, that the reason why, and I take responsibility for how I ended up in here. Like, it's, I don't blame anybody else or anything, but at the same time, when you look at it and you start to understand why things happen the way that they do, a lot of it happens for a reason. It doesn't just happen for no reason out of nowhere. Like you said, like the environment that you grew up in, these were the circumstances. These were the things that influenced you, that put you into the position that landed you in getting that life sentence, you know, myself, I was raised in with my mother. My parents split up. I was in a broken home. My mom lived out in the country. My dad lived in a trailer park, you know, and, at an early age, I had a lot of older cousins and family members and stuff that were really, really heavy into selling drugs. And so I got put into that environment around that at around the age of 11. And so that was kind of what spurred the events that transpired from there. I got caught up in some stuff when I was around 13 for the first time, went to juvenile, and then I got put on a youth at risk program. And so I started running away and I started hanging out, you know, throughout these activities that I was doing. I landed myself, you know, I'm from a rather small town, like 30 or 40,000, but in the, you know, downtown area, you know, the hood or whatever you would want to call it, is an area where a lot of these similar types of activities are taking place. And so I found myself encapsulated with that lifestyle, and I transgressed from there into, when I was 15, I got sent away to a school, which was a pretty bad place. It was called Tranquility Bay, and it was like a behavioral modification program. It was in Jamaica. And so these places were very torturous and abusive towards children, and they later got shut down. You know, I was there over a year. When I came back, I wasn't like, it messed me up, kind of like PTSD, I guess you would call it, to where, you know, I'd spent in isolation in rooms for weeks where I had to lay on my face on the floor face down. And if I got up or moved or anything like that, they would come in and beat me, you know? And so that was for anything, kind of like a military where you had to do like really crazy military style workouts. It wasn't a military school, but it had elements of that type of stuff in there. And then when I came back, I was 16, and I went and lived with my dad, and he ended up kicking me out shortly after that. So I was just out on the streets, you know, from then until the time I was 20, and I got caught up in this situation, which, like, to be honest with you, I'm wrongfully convicted of the crime they convicted me of. And so I'm still fighting that in the courts on appeal, because I do take responsibility for my actions that led me up to that point, you know?
Right.
But I'm not guilty of what I got convicted of, but because of the circumstances and the people and the places and all the things that I was doing, it landed me here. But to be honest with you, man, and it was something that you said in your book, without having that life sentence, it doesn't always put things in the same perspective. So I think that is the curse of my life, but it's also the blessing. It's also the biggest blessing, because it might not have given me that wake up call if it wasn't, you know, if I had 5 years or something like that, or 10 years, it might not have changed the perspectives. It made me look at things differently. So I definitely think that the upbringing, the places, the things that happen around you in the environment have a huge impact on what determines how a kid grows up and where he ends up, whether he ends up in prison or not.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. One of the things that I do that's really important to me is remaining a social justice advocate. And so I will write op-eds. I will go down to Capitol Hill. I will go speak before legislators here in Annapolis, Maryland. But it's always difficult to convey the plight of people like us who've been raised under difficult circumstances. And oftentimes, when I'm speaking before these folks, they would talk about one particular crime, terrible crime, where, you know, some young person stabbed some woman you know, multiple times, and they use that one instance to justify super punitive laws and practices for all of us, right? One fish acts up, they drain the whole pond, right? If you had the opportunity to sit before someone, a legislative who had the power to pass legislation that was fair, that rewarded people who embraced rehabilitation, therapy, and education, what would you say to that individual if you had a few seconds to talk about why it's important?
Well, I think that the biggest thing to look at is it's like group punishment, capital punishment, which happens all the time inside of here just for the smallest things. And you look at the cause and effects of how that, like, what does that do? Does that really solve the problem? Like, if you look into the statistics on how these crime bills that massively incarcerate people and lock people up for, you know, essentially life sentences for a possession charge in some cases. Yeah, I know you're talking about like stabbing somebody, which is definitely a much more severe crime, but putting into perspective, like the thing of it is one bad apple spoiling the whole bunch spoils the society, because you're taking away from many families the ability to rehabilitate, the ability to have redemption. And that's what the country that we live in is supposed to stand for, is being able to give people another opportunity, you know, to be able to have, I mean, in the Constitution itself, it says that if there is redeemable qualities about a person, that you're supposed to be able to, you know, have those redeemable qualities. You're supposed to be able to have an opportunity for that redemption. Right. But totally. With the way that they're handing out so many life sentences and the way that people are becoming incarcerated by, you know, the millions nowadays, it doesn't give that opportunity. It's like people are just thrown away and never to be heard from again, you know, and the one size fits all method is not working for anybody. It's not working for the system. It's not working for society, you know, in the way that I bring this up as not something that is like the money that it costs to lock people up is incredible. If you would just take that money and invest it into education, you would, you know, the amount of people that actually come back to prison or keep continuing in that cycle is like minuscule, you know?
Yep. I agree. And thanks for sharing that. I have one more question. And of course, you can ask me some questions if you want, but I'm curious. I had contracted COVID-19 last year, January. I suffered for a long time, almost a month. I was really sick, almost passed away, and I still struggle with health issues. But I couldn't help but wonder, once I started to slowly recover, of what it was like. And I've read about and I've heard about how bad it has been for folks incarcerated. But can you share how COVID-19 has impacted people incarcerated in your experience?
Yeah. Real quick, because I'm almost out of time here, but I definitely, you know, I contracted COVID-19 myself about a couple of months ago. And, you know, the experience of going through it before that, they had us in lockdown for, you know, basically essentially all the day for 2 months straight, to where we couldn't even come out of our cells. But about maybe 45 minutes a day, 30 to 45 minutes a day, just to take a shower. There was days when I didn't even get out at all. And so that was the living scenario for a couple of months. And then I myself contracted it. And then I was taken to another area where everybody else that had it was at. And I spent, you know, the next couple of weeks while going through the motions of it. And I had one of the milder cases of it, thankfully. And it didn't impact me as much as some of the other people that I've seen coming and going from the hospital. There were some deaths, unfortunately, that took place, and nearly over three quarters of the entire facility contracted the virus. And so, wow. You know, but the thing was, is I didn't have that much symptoms throughout having it, but afterwards, after I was cleared and I came back to my unit and everything, I had like this lingering effect of just being tired. And I've had that ever since. Like it drained my energy, you know, so it would be difficult just to continue functioning. And, you know, it's still currently like in these modified lockdowns to where we don't get that much time out. It's opened up a little bit more. And, you know, it's really has been an isolated effect. We haven't been able to have any visitings. You know, visitings are a very important part, like something to look forward to be able to remain and have that physical connection to the outside, get a hug from somebody, you know, the only type of affection that we have. And we haven't been able to have that for a year now. So, I mean, some of these strains have been very difficult to endure. You know, very difficult, not only for us, but for the family members as well.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that.
But
do you have any questions? I'm not sure how much time we have left, but do you have any questions for me? Any other things you want to mention?
Yeah, I just want to say, man, that I really think it's cool what you're doing, the tablet deal that you spoke about with the educational platform that you're launching through the master plan and sharing your story through that and like getting people involved in creating their own master plan. Because I think, you know, attaching your story and what you've been through, that you were actually a lifer that got out and is doing well and really following through with this stuff, I think is something that makes a big impact and can continue to make a big impact, because it gives a lot of credibility, you know, to and hope to, like, these things are possible if you work for it, you know. And I do have one last question before I gotta go, because I really they're gonna shut me down here in just a minute. But I just gotta know how it was that you managed to not get a single infraction the whole time that you were in prison, man. Because that is extremely impressive.
So what I realized is that 85% of the time when I got in trouble before I went to prison, I put myself in situations to get in trouble. So I hung around with people who, you know, would gamble and not pay any bills when they lost, all kinds of stuff. And so I started watching my surroundings and people who I called my friends. And so I realized a lot of times my friends would get me in trouble. And so once I chose a different group of people to hang with, we started making different decisions. Once I started embracing education and especially therapy and controlling my anger and thinking about the end game, it could be something simple where in the past I would, you know, maybe cut someone out or maybe just, you know, do something crazy. I would say, well, if I do this, then maybe it will reduce my chances of being released or make a parole. And maybe I won't be able to buy that Corvette or start that business. And so I would walk away from stuff. I would resolve stuff in a way that made sense. Well, I wouldn't put myself in the situation in the first place. And so I was able to go 16 and a half years without catching a single infraction.
That's amazing. And I wish I would have had that foresight in the beginning of my incarceration. You know,
it's never too late. And you seem like you're on the right track now. And so, you know, I wish you the best. I hope you're working on your own master plan and thinking about what your end game is. And I will continue to check in with you to the best of my ability. And I really wish you the best, brother. I mean that.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate it a lot, and I got much respect for you, man. And what you're doing is amazing. I appreciate you giving us the time here to, you know, talk to us and give us this insight into what you got going on and how you're doing it. And I definitely got my end game, and I keep it in sight at all times. And yeah, I've been without infractions for like the last 10 years. So I've got 15 in total right now. And, you know, but yeah, man, it's definitely what you got to do. It's about the people that you hang out with. So I think that you got that part figured out early on. And that's that's what people got to do. If they want to do better, you got to look at who you're hanging around with, because you're going to be influenced by those type of people.
100%.
So,
yeah, brother, this was great, man. And hopefully, I'm sure we'll get to chat again. But thanks so much for putting this all together for us to have a chance to talk. And I hope people who hear this have a better understanding of what's happening behind the scenes and how people like us end up in prison. But most importantly, that we deserve second chances and our lives are redeemable.
Absolutely, man. I couldn't have said it better myself. And once again, I appreciate it, Chris, and thank you for taking the time out. And this is Taylor Conley for The Life of a Lifer. Make sure to tune back in. Thank you for listening. I'm Taylor Conley, and this is Life of a Lifer podcast. Be sure to visit the website, lifeofalifer.com, and don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.